Welcome to the BBB National Programs Podcast Better Series, where we will explore top-of-mind topics with business and industry leaders to understand the leading trends and innovations that continue to push the envelope in today's marketplace.
Thank you for joining us today on the Better Series podcast. I'm James Lee. Have you tried to hire somebody lately? For many, if not most, business owners and hiring managers, these can be very frustrating times. With an ultra-low unemployment rate, the job landscape in some industries is more like reverse musical chairs, where there are not enough players to fill the seats when the music stops. For a growing company, finding the talent to scale your business is vital to success and can mean the difference between long-term success or short-term failure. So what do you do if you're spending your days trolling LinkedIn for job candidates? Here's a quote. There is no good substitute for a corporate philosophy that puts its employees' happiness and wealth on par with its return to investors. That's a quote from today's guest, a New York Times best-selling author, Forbes columnist, and guy who, in his own words, researches and advises on why people do what they do. Rod Wagner, thank you for joining us today.
James, great to be with you.
So, I won't tell everybody how long we've known each other, but I do know that you've spent your entire career looking at what makes businesses, teams, and even individual leaders successful. How many folks do you think you've talked to over the years?
Gee, you know, it changes from week to week. If I'm speaking at a conference, I could easily get the chance to talk to 100 or more. If I'm writing a book chapter, I might only talk to 5 or 6 during the course of the week. I suppose most honest answer is that I haven't kept track, but it's probably around 5,000, give or take.
Oh, my goodness. Well, in talking to all those people, I'm sure you've learned a lot about the must-haves that business leaders need to build in order to be successful. So what would you tell people?
I think there's just really one must-have, and that's a conscience. Everything flows from that, and nothing else can compensate for a lack of one. If you're invested in the happiness of your employees, you will work through everything else, whether we're talking about fair compensation or a vision for the company, flexible hours, or any of the other crucial ingredients. Having researched their partnership for my second book, Power of Two, I'm a big fan of Bill Hewlett and David Packard. And what really comes through in what they said, what they wrote, what they did, is a deep concern for the happiness of their employees that I'm not sure you see all that often in companies today. You know, I was at one of those conferences and a very young man, maybe mid-20s, came up to me and he said, I'm a new manager, and I'm really worried that they just made me a manager. I'm really worried that I won't be a good manager. And I told him, you know what? You're going to be fine precisely because you're worried about it. It's the ones who blow off their responsibility that cause the greatest harm. So, yeah, it ultimately comes down to that conscience.
Well, that poses an interesting dilemma then. Yeah, if you're the business leader and you're looking for people who have a conscience, or if you're the job seeker and you're looking for a company that has a conscience, how do you find each other? That's not something you usually see in a job description.
No, but I do think it comes through in the little idiosyncrasies, the little giveaways when you sit down and ask someone what their vision is for the company. And if the conversation is all me, 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 here's what we did, and here's who I am, that's a pretty good giveaway. You're dealing with a narcissist, as opposed to someone that talks about, here's where we're going together, and here's how this particular employee has excelled quite nicely, and here's how cool it is to see where we're all going together. So if the conversation, maybe that's the easiest thing, is just filter it. How much me do you hear versus we?
That's interesting. You mentioned Hewlett Packard, the two gentlemen who formed the company. Are there other organizations like that who have been built based on this concept of a company with a conscience, happiness of their employees?
I don't think they get enough credit. Maybe get taken for granted, but the branches of the military get this quite well. I just interviewed Michael Abershoff, who's a keynote speaker at a conference, the Safe Start Human Factors Conference, where I'm also speaking in November. And his conversation was all about the men and women on his ship and empowering them, making sure they had a good experience, making sure they had enough sleep, which was not the priority that it currently is in the U.S. Navy, and setting a vision for what they could do together. I think there's an awful lot of commanders out there on Navy ships and commanders in the other branches of the military that actually have this dialed in much more than we commonly appreciate.
So if I'm building a business today and I've begun to see some success, it's time to start thinking about adding new people to the team and, you know, scaling up as the buzzwords of the day is. How do you do that without putting at risk the spark that made you successful to that point?
I think it begins by defining what that spark is, because it differs from one organization to another, whether you're talking about healthcare or homeland security or simply making the best donuts out there. Every company, one would hope, stands for something. And it's important that a company take the time to talk about what that spark is and to communicate it, to pass the torch, as it were. I think one of the problems for a small, quickly growing business is sometimes the enemy is simply the activity level being so high that those leaders who have the spark find it hard to make the time to pass the torch. Obviously, a company leader needs to be very careful about recruiting and preparing the next level of leadership, those who he or she has confidence in and those who he or she sees has that kind of a vision and has that conscience. But every company will reach a point where the founder or the founders, plural, retire or at least are temporarily sidelined. It's much better to hit that question earlier on, to take a hypothetical. Hey, let's just pretend next week that that I'm not here for whatever reason. What do we do next? And since at some point I'm not going to be here, let's talk next week about, in the hypothetical, what that plan would be so that when it comes to fruition, we're prepared for it. Most growing businesses, it's just things are moving too fast. People are out of breath. They just don't take the time to do that.
So in a previous time, we'd call that succession planning, and which is something that nobody ever wants to do. But it sounds like it's still vitally important to the health of an organization.
I think people avoid it because nobody likes the idea that at some point they're going to be gone, either from the company or from the planet. So just like writing a will or picking out a grave site, succession plan sounds so terribly final. So I certainly appreciate why people don't want to do it. But you leave, just like not having a will, you leave people behind in a mess if you don't.
Yeah, it's also important, not just at the top level of the organization. Isn't it important throughout the organization? So, you know, for team leaders as well as company, you know, the top of the company.
Yes, not as much as the top of the company. That's where you create a real crisis. That's where you can lose a lot of people. And it's also a place where you wouldn't necessarily have others within the organization that you could borrow or move over. An organization that has 20 plants around North America, if it gets into a real bind, can borrow a plant manager from someplace else. There are many people who are in that particular role, but most companies only have one CFO, one chief operating officer, one CEO. And those people tend to hang on to their positions and tend not to teach others what it is that they do so that they can take over.
Let's talk about diversity and inclusion. So when you're building this team now that you're scaling up, the perception is anyway that there's this tendency that you want to hire people who look and act and think just like you if you're the founder. But that's not necessarily the way to build a healthy organization, is it?
No, not at all. In the book that Dr. Gail Muller and I wrote, we talked about the idea of complementary strengths or complementary abilities And the most strategic thing to do is to look for someone who is the opposite of you. Learn how to have the same vision, learn to trust each other and communicate on similar grounds, but you really want someone who is yin to your yang, who is risk averse to your idea of jumping in and investing too early. It's a natural inclination. In fact, it's really deep seated that we collaborate first and foremost with those who are most like us, but those are actually the people we need least. And it requires that you requires that you get beyond yourself and that you get very deliberate about it, recognizing that it is a bias and countering it. I think to get beyond your own demographics, it requires that you cast a wider net. Yes, we have this deep-seated natural bias. On the other hand, it's never been easier to broadly get the word out that you're hiring. And most college student bodies are reasonably diversified. You call the local professor and ask, or a professor from a couple area codes over, maybe different type of neighborhood or different draw that they get, and ask, hey, who's really smart? Who's coming up? And the other thing, you talked about trolling LinkedIn. Almost everyone is on LinkedIn. Trolling LinkedIn is fantastic. Imagine 20 years ago if they said that someday we'd have this tool that would have everybody's resume posted. HR would have been absolutely salivating. So to some degree, it's kind of an excuse these days as far as being able to cast a wide net and find some people who are different than us. It's a lot more easy. It's a lot easier to do now than it has been in the past.
Now, you know, we've talked previously about the role of collaboration. That's another way that you can bring different points of view into an organization, isn't it? You know, either partner with or contract with or just mentor and be mentored by somebody who doesn't think and act like you.
We do have this hang up, and I think it's made worse by the fact that you can get so much done alone now with our technology and vehicles and internet and all those kinds of things. I think we're losing some of our collaborative instincts, but I'm a huge advocate, obviously, since I wrote a whole book about it with Dr. Mueller, of the idea of pairing up with someone who's quite different from you, who has a different point of view. It's actually legislated if you're in an industrial environment that you, in many cases, be there with someone else. You go to Reagan National Airport, you're not going to see a lot of jets flying out with just one pilot. You need some redundancy there. Scuba divers, any serious dive, you go down with someone else, and there's any kind of a confined space or many other hazardous situations, you're required to have someone else there to back you up. And I think that's also true when you're talking about intellectual pursuits, making sure that you're thinking something through. I just think there's nothing more valuable than having someone with a different set of eyes, not just a second set of eyes, but one who sees the world differently, looking through that work product and deciding if it needs any revisions or if you've missed anything.
You know, when we talk about these things, we tend to think about, you know, race and gender, which are clearly an issue, but also age seems to be becoming a bigger part of diversity and a struggle for companies. I have experience in the startup world, and it is clearly an issue in that world. How do we begin to address that issue given the demographics of the country with the, you have so many people who don't want to stop working as a baby boomer and so many young people coming into the workforce now and having a tremendous impact on it? How do we address that issue of ageism versus the more traditional concerns we've had around diversity?
Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, there's not a lot of workers. So business leaders should be thankful that the baby boomers want to keep working. And there's also something really cool that happens when in those cases where someone's made enough money that now they're working not because they need the paycheck, but because they really enjoy what they do. It's a cool thing about some of those boomers that are still in the market. But I think they can start by having their radar up on the age issue as much as it usually is on race and gender. I'm amazed by the kind of generational stereotyping that gets by that would never pass muster for race and gender. There's a really easy test for this. Anytime someone says, well, here's what millennials are like, or any other generation, substitute African Americans or Hispanics or women for the word millennials. And it's like fingers on a chalkboard. Like, well, you can't say that. You can't generalize like that. So how do we address it? I think it begins with not thinking of people in groups, but thinking of them as individuals.
Now, when you and I first met, you know, engagement, that was the buzzword of the day. And, you know, we started with, you know, employee and customer satisfaction. Then we went to employee and customer loyalty. But nirvana was employee and customer engagement. Is that still true today?
It is. I wrote a column in Forbes a few years back where I suggested that the term was contaminated enough that it would rotate out. You do hear some references to employee value proposition and employee experience that seem to be edging out the term engagement. But to the degree that by engagement, we mean the scientifically grounded aspects of a job that are most motivating to employees, yes, it's a driver of growth. And it always will be, because it's true to human nature. I use terms such as engagement or morale or employee satisfaction, employee happiness, somewhat interchangeably, because statistically, and therefore psychologically, they overlap heavily. But if by engagement we mean that hackneyed program to take attendance and do a survey and find out who's engaged and who's disengaged and then pile insults on those who are not suitably chipper, that brand of, quote, engagement, unquote, will actually kill a company.
Well, so much for having my best friend at work then. So
that's a goofy question anyway. It's nowhere near. I wrote a piece in the Harvard Business Review a few years ago. I was one of the original defenders of it because it does have some statistical power, but actually, if you ask questions about collaboration and teamwork, you'll get a much stronger connection to business outcomes.
So I want to end where we began, which is happiness. Happiness in the workplace. How do leaders achieve that, and what's the outcome?
Well, I wrote about 12 of those aspects in my most recent book, Widgets, and I won't rehearse all of them here, but they all come down to that issue of conscience that we talked about earlier. In one of my Forbes columns, I labeled it core intentions. When you get down to someone's heart, how do they really feel about their employees? So if you have that, then you get to issues, like I said, I won't rehearse all of them, but individualizing, work-life balance, good pay, not scaring people, giving people chances to show what they can do, creating conditions for great teamwork. None of these is all that difficult to understand. It's really putting in the hard work to deliver them to your employees. One of the things that always shows up very strongly anytime I do any research around employees is whether or not their manager takes them to coffee every couple weeks and sits down and talks with them. That's not rocket science. And yet, if you ask those managers and leaders, when was the last time you went to coffee with this person, they'll say, well, it's been a while. Okay, it's not rocket science. It just work. You need to be deliberate about delivering those things to your employees, and then they will reciprocate very strongly on behalf of the company.
Rod Wagner, I'm happy you could join us today.
Thank you, James.
You can order Ron's books at your favorite bookstore or online bookseller, and you can read his columns on Forbes.com. And thank you for joining us today on the BBB National Program's Better Series podcast. Be sure to join us next month for a special multi-part series we're calling Retail Therapy, where we take a look at what's happening in the largest segment of the U.S. economy, the retail sector, and how that impacts you. To make sure you don't miss Retail Therapy or any other episode of the Better Series, subscribe today at bbbprograms.org, then click on the podcast tab. And as always, you can listen to more Better Series episodes on iTunes or your favorite streaming platform.
You just enjoyed the Better Series podcast. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To learn more about our other shows, visit betterbusiness.blueberry.com. That's betterbusiness.blueberry.com. Follow us on Twitter at @BBB_NTL Programs. Send your comments and ideas to podcasts@BBBNP.org. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guest, not those of the BBB National Programs or its affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Blueberry's Terms of Service.